What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense, political talk without the boring parts. I'm John Wiener. Later in the show, movies and politics. No political figure has blurred the line between them more than Ronald Reagan, and no president understood the power of collective fantasy better than Reagan did. That's what the great movie critic Jay Hoberman says. We'll speak with him later in the hour. His new book about movie culture in the age of Reagan is called Make My Day. But first, how is Trump doing? The primary election season is in full swing, and the new polls are pouring in. For comment, we turn to Jeet here. Of course, he's national affairs correspondent for The Nation. We reached him today in Toronto. Hi, Jeet.
Oh, hi, John.
Well, the new Fox poll shows Trump in terrible shape right now. It shows that Biden would beat him 50-38. Bernie would beat him 48-39. Elizabeth Warren would beat him 46-39. And this is the Fox poll. Is the Fox poll a good poll?
Yeah, Fox, we might not like the cable news station or its spin, but they hire out their polls and they use very good pollsters and they have one of the best reputations. And also, I think more interestingly, it shows that he's polling lower than his approval ratings. That could be bad news for him because in 2016, he got more votes than his approval rating, partially because he's running against a very unpopular rival as well. And so people chose him as the lesser of two evils. That might not be the case this time.
You know, he's never been a popular politician, and it seems pretty clear that he has no intention of becoming popular. He's not doing any of the things that would win over people who don't like him.
Trump's whole governing style has been to try to keep the Republican base on side and keep them to him. And I think he's done that for a very good reason, which is that he's had all sorts of corruptions and scandals. And if the Republican Party ever abandons him, he could be in like serious trouble, not like electoral trouble, like impeachment trouble and possibly criminal justice trouble. So it's been to his own personal advantage to try to keep Republicans on board with him as much. And he's giving them tax cuts and a lot of Republican judges. But this is not the type of stuff that's going to win over anyone who didn't like Trump before. I wanted to add one other point about Trump not winning people over, which is I think that it's also a matter of his own beliefs. That he is genuinely committed to a sort of nativist, racist agenda. And whenever these issues come up, he often puts them to the foreground, not just to appeal to his base, but because that's what he wants. And that's not winning him any votes either.
So why does Trump think that he can get reelected with the vote of his base and nobody else? His base is nowhere near a majority. Even if he gets his approval rating, that's 42% or 43%, and that is not going to get him elected.
Yeah, I suspect that Trump will think that he can try to replicate what happened in 2016, which is that he's unpopular, but he can try to make the Democratic rival as unpopular, and that would depress some of the Democratic vote, and it would also rile up his own voters and get people who are wavering on his side. Among people who disliked both Trump and Clinton in 2016, Trump won them. So I think it's a matter of that. And also, thank you, founding fathers, but you don't need a majority of the vote or the most votes to become president. because the Electoral College could still favor him in theory. So I think that's the strategy he's running on, like a replay of 2016.
You pointed out that in 2016, he was running against a very unpopular Democrat, historically unpopular, almost as unpopular as he was. Doesn't seem like that's what's happening in 2020. All the leading Democratic candidates are a lot more popular than he was at this point three, 4 years ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, they're more popular than he was. And more importantly, they're more popular than Hillary Clinton.
And there's problems with his base. The new NBC Wall Street Journal poll has a huge danger sign for Trump among white women without college degrees. Trump trails the generic Democrat by 6 percentage points. In 2016, exit polls showed him beating Hillary among these same voters, white women without college degrees, by 27 percentage points.
Yeah, I think it is a huge problem that the it's not just he hasn't expanded his base, but there are key parts of his base that are leaving. I think also some of the suburban Republicans who, after the Comey letter came, decided to go with Trump, it seems like he's clearly lost them just based on 2018. And white women without a college education, it seems like they don't like a lot of the gender stuff, the, you know, the Stormy Daniels stuff. And they also, interestingly enough, some of the polling shows they don't like the racial incitement.
You reminded us that you don't need a popular majority to become president of the United States because of the Electoral College. And so what we really should look at is the state-by-state polls. And here we have approval polls that are fascinating and very bad for Trump. The early to mid-August state-by-state job approval ratings show that in 10 of the states he carried in 2016, his net approval ratio, that is the ratio of approval to disapproval, is negative. More people disapprove of him than approve of him. And this is among registered voters in Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Michigan, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Wisconsin, all states he carried in 2016. He now has more people who disapprove of him than approve of him. This would make for a landslide for the Democratic candidate. How seriously should we take these polls?
I think we should take them with some degree of seriousness. Although I think, sort of proviso is that, like, if you go back to 2011, Obama was underwater in some states that he would, you know, go on to recarry in 2012. So, like, nothing is written in stone. But it is the case that, yeah, there's a lot of states that he carried that he's becoming unpopular in. And we know that this has a real impact just from 2018. I mean, those were precisely the areas where the Democrats regained the House. And so I think that it is a problem. I mean, Texas is a long shot, but it is really fascinating how close Beto O'Rourke came to winning in 2018, how well Democrats did in sort of down-ballot races, and how Republicans in Texas are very scared, and quite a few of them are not running again for Congress. So from that, even more than the polling, we can kind of tell which way the wind is blowing.
And it's not like the polls show him close in the states he carried in 2016. He's 12 points behind in the approval polls in Pennsylvania, 11 in Michigan, 9 in Arizona, North Carolina, and Wisconsin. That's a lot. And as for the chance that Trump would be doing better in states that narrowly went for Clinton in 2016, that isn't happening either. His approval ratings are minus 18 in Colorado, minus 15 in Minnesota, minus 12 in Nevada, and an astounding minus 27 in New Hampshire. And these are polls of registered voters, not just adults.
Yeah, so it's hard to imagine him gaining new states based on that. And it's easy to imagine him losing states that he had won. And I mean, one should never forget the narrowness of his electoral college victory, which really came down to under 80,000 votes in three states.
So how could he win? What's his best chance?
Well, I think that the best chance would, which maybe he should have been pursuing all along, is to just keep quiet and just like run on, you know, like a fairly decent economy. Don't tweet, don't pick fights, claim credit for whatever good happens, but don't be in people's faces so much. And then maybe, you know, like voters might decide, like, why change horses in midstream? Like, why rock the boat? And I think that strategy might have worked, especially if the economy keeps up. But I think that's the other headwind he's going to run into, where, you know, there are some signs of an economic recession coming. And certainly there's definite signs that the White House is panicking about this. Kellyanne Conway was on TV saying, you know, the fundamentals of the economy are sound. And whenever I hear that, I remember, you know, that's exactly what Herbert Hoover said in October 1929.
That's why I'm laughing. Excellent point. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other things that Trump could rely on are building fear of his opponent, especially if it's Bernie or Elizabeth Warren. These people are, you know, radical un-American socialists. Do you think? I mean, there's certainly some potential there, don't you think?
I think that there is some potential, although I feel like the one worry there would be among older Democrats, you know, who are kind of grew up in the Cold War and for whom socialism is a dirty word. I think this is especially a concern with Bernie. But it happens, like, there's a lot of polling about Bernie himself. And the thing is, people, they have a sense of a candidate as well as a sense of where they stand. And I think more people, and people react to personality as much as ideology. I don't think a lot of Americans can define what socialism is, but they have a sense of that, like, they know Bernie, they know he's a candidate, you know, who kind of stands for ordinary people. And that, you know, like, yeah, and so he tends to poll well. He's second really only to Biden in going head-to-head against Trump. Especially among the younger generation, like, I feel like the sort of socialist accusation has really no salience. So, yeah, it doesn't worry me so much. The one worry I have, if it's Warren or Sanders, is not that they'll be seen as too extreme, but that some centrist billionaire like Bloomberg or Schultz will, like, run a third-party campaign.
And, of course, there's one other thing that would help Trump win, and that is some huge disaster, another 9/11 war with Iran.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if there's a terrorist attack, I guess all bets are off. We wouldn't necessarily know, although I feel like the sort of patriotic rallying behind the president that we saw after 9/11, I'm not sure it would come to Trump. Like, he's polarized the country in a way that he can't take that mantle so easily. And if there's a war again, I mean, there's a lot of, like, polling saying that, you know, people are very distrustful, very tired of the forever wars. At this point where, like, you know, the youngest soldiers in the American Army were born after 9/11. So you have soldiers that are younger than the wars that they're going to be sent to fight in. And I just don't think that there's a popular appetite for military adventures.
Well, the heart of Trump's campaign is hatred and fear of immigrants. And there's an evil mind behind Trump's anti-immigrant agenda, the mind of Stephen Miller. Both the New York Times and the Washington Post recently ran long page one pieces on Stephen Miller. You wrote about them. You said these pieces were smart and well-researched, but you called them disheartening. Why?
Well, I think Miller gets us, you know, pretty close to where the Republican Party is. Like, I think if you look at sort of Trump himself and other figures that sort of have swarmed around Trump, it's easy to have this idea that this is all an anomaly, that, like, basically this sort of pirate entertainer hijacked a political party and lucked his way into the presidency. Trump is a very odd figure, as is someone like Stephen Bannon, who likes to quote sort of obscure fascist thinkers, or someone like Sebastian Gorka. But Miller, if you look at Miller's biography, he's really like a sort of very garden variety Republican. Like, you can see people like him on any college campus as the sort of, you know, college Republicans. And he's followed a trajectory that's very common to the Republican Party. So he's really represents the norm. And I think that that maybe explains why he's been the most successful of Trump's staffers, in the sense that he's, like, you know, he hasn't been kicked out the way Bannon and Gorka were. He's he avoids the limelight. He praises Trump all the time. But more importantly, he's Trump has a sense that, like, you know, Miller's anti-immigration agenda is what the GOP wants. And Miller has built a kind of substantial network that has really made sort of nativism the dominant force in the GOP.
Well, anti-immigrant politics are something fairly new to the Republicans. Reagan said that it was, quote, millions of immigrants from every corner of the earth, close quote, who showed that God had made America a city on a hill. As recently as 2012, when Romney lost to Obama, the official Republican Party autopsy concluded that the party had to devote itself to recruiting Latino voters by supporting comprehensive immigration reform. What made them think they could recruit Latino voters after 2012?
Well, there's a longstanding thought that, Latino voters are Catholic, more conservative, many of them involved in small businesses. But the GOP pro-immigration position really came from the donors. And it came from the business elite that, really values cheap labor. If you look behind figures like Reagan and the Bushes, there's always been a rising undercurrent of nativism that really, took off in the 1980s and emerged as a force with figures like Pat Buchanan and the sort of paleoconservatives, and especially intensified after 9/11, where, I would argue, the global war on terror really gave a legitimacy to sort of xenophobic fears. So, and you saw a lot of sort of popular Islamophobia and organizations that are promoting a more nativist policies. And Miller really glommed onto that. I mean, he came from Santa Monica. And I think the California GOP is particularly nativist.
Yeah.
Because they blame their electoral failure on, whites becoming a minority. Miller really came out of a California Republican Party and did a network for Republican students such as himself. Once they hit college, there are newspapers and programs for them to get internships at Congress. And he picked up on the wave of the rising xenophobia and went to work first for Michelle Bachmann and later with Jeff Sessions. And Sessions was a real powerhouse behind the sort of nativist wing of the GOP. And I think Miller's career shows that nativist wing has now become dominant, that the older business wing of Reagan, Bush, and Romney really hasn't carried the day.
So Michelle Bachmann, his first employer, is gone. Jeff Sessions is gone. Kirstjen Nielsen, who was in charge of anti-immigrant policy for a while, is gone. How come Stephen Miller is still there?
I think Miller has convinced Trump and also Trump's family. It seems like Jared Kushner and Ivanka are both his patrons. He convinced them that he's their pipeline to the nativist wing of the GOP, and that as long as he stays, he can they'll have credibility with that wing. And also, I think Trump himself agrees with him. Whenever there's an attempt to reach an immigration compromise, Miller is there, whispering in Trump's ear that this means we'll get more people coming in from those. Well, we all know what Trump thinks of those countries, right? Poor countries filled with non-white people. And so Trump, freaks out and agrees with Miller. So I think there's a real mind meld between Miller and Trump, but that mind meld is more reflective of where the GOP is. But also, Trump will be gone one day. And even if Miller is gone, I think that there's a whole infrastructure and industry mass producing people like Miller. And there'll be 10 or 15 more Millers to replace him. The real issue is that the Republican Party has decided that immigration from non-white countries is an existential threat to them, that they can never win over these voters. They'll be defeated out. And so therefore, it's in their own best interest to try to stop immigration. The only solution I can see is if Republicans lose enough elections consecutively, if they say they lost the presidency three times in a row, right? Then they might think we have to change our message. We have to figure out how to adjust to Browning America. But aside from that, it's going to be Stephen Miller is going to be our future for the foreseeable future. He's going to be the mainstay of the GOP.
Jeet here. He wrote about Stephen Miller for thenation.com. Thank you, Jeet.
Thank you.
Now a message from Politico. The biggest problems facing the world don't respect political boundaries. But are our politicians and other leaders up to the task of solving them? Join host Louisa Savage and Politico journalists from across the world as they unpack the answer to that question on Politico's Global Translations podcast. The first season examines who will write global rules for trade, for new technologies like 5G and AI, and for fighting climate change. Search for Politico's Global Translations on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this show.
The synergy between politics and popular culture has never been clearer or stronger than in the age of Reagan. And now there's a wonderful new book on movie culture in the age of Reagan. It's called Make My Day, and the author is Jay Hoberman. For 30 years, he was a film critic for The Village Voice. He's also written for Art Forum, The New York Review, The New York Times, and The Nation. He's written a dozen books, including the brilliant Army of Phantoms, American Movies in the Making of the Cold War. Jay Hoberman, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
When you write about movie culture in the age of Reagan, you focus not on what you think are the best movies of the 80s or the movies you most admire. In fact, you pay a lot of attention to the movies you dislike. Why is that?
Well, the fact that I dislike these movies doesn't mean that they're not interesting for me to write about. And I chose movies that I felt were symptomatic of what was going on both in politics and the culture at large.
And Reagan, of course, was often dismissed by liberals as just an actor from old Hollywood. But you think the fact that he was part of old Hollywood gave him a special power and success as president?
Definitely. There are two things here. I mean, first of all, when he ran for governor of California, the liberals and the Democrats just did not take him seriously. He seemed like a lightweight. And how was he going to beat Pat Brown, a two-term governor of California and a real political powerhouse? What they didn't realize was that an actor knows how to present. An actor knows how to deliver a line. An actor can hit their marks. It's very difficult for a politician to compete with somebody who's that polished and professional at projecting an image. The other thing, and maybe the more significant one, is that Reagan bought into the whole Hollywood package, particularly in the 1940s. And what I mean by that is that, taken as a whole, American movies had a particular kind of ideology. They were very optimistic, forward-thinking, imagined that they were inclusive. I mean, in fact, they were not, but they had that self-appointed sense of universal appeal. Certainly, they wanted to appeal universally. And mandated happy endings. I mean, there was a production code into the 1960s that kept things from getting too real. I think that Reagan internalized all of this, and this is why I consider him Hollywood's greatest creation. I mean, he sincerely believed this stuff. And the one real takeaway I had from doing research at the Reagan Library, if I'm not mistaken, you've done work there too, have
yes.
you not? But what I did take away from this was the degree to which Hollywood was still so central in his thinking. I mean, you know, his wife had been in the movies also. Nancy was a minor star. And I really think that this was the high point of their lives. I mean, being president was very nice, and he certainly enjoyed it. But I think that it's really not as great as being a movie star, even when he wasn't, you know, in the first rung. I mean, just to be part of that. And I say this because they stayed in touch with people. They spent a lot of time reaching out, you know, making videos. I mean, they spent a month making a birthday video for Lou Wasserman, who had been their agent and who was at that time the leading Democratic fundraiser in California, did not make any difference to them. He was, you know, they were together in showbiz. He was their guru, you know, he was their rabbi. And so he was not a great movie star, but he I think he embodied Hollywood more completely than any other star.
Well, let's talk about some of the movies. After Reagan was reelected in 1984 in a landslide, you wrote a big piece for The Village Voice where you said that during that campaign year, only one film, quote, mirrored Reaganism in full flower, and that film was Ghostbusters. You called it aesthetically weak but ideologically potent. Tell us about Ghostbusters.
Okay. Now, the reason I said that was that Ghostbusters, I think objectively, and, you know, I was a working movie critic in 1984, so I saw a lot of movies. I didn't find Ghostbusters really that funny. I mean, I saw certain things in it that were appealing, but, you know, the setup was kind of fun, but the movie was not that funny. But it inspired, like, almost, you know, like a fanatical devotion. It overperformed. People saw something in there that they really wanted. And I think that the same thing was true with Reagan. And it's not like Ghostbusters is an allegory of Reaganism, or that Reagan was taking cues from Ghostbusters. It's that they're both symptomatic of the same thing, this longing for the world to be in a certain way. And, you know, you and I remember this, but lots of people don't. 1984 was a year that had, like, a really uncanny significance for Americans and for people in the West in general, being the year of George Orwell's dystopian novel.
Yeah.
And I feel that in a funny sort of way, both Reagan and the movie liquidated that anxiety. And this is despite the fact that Reagan was a terrible saber rattler, if not warmonger, you know, throughout 1983. I mean, he conjured up a crisis, which he then dissipated, which is exactly what the Ghostbusters are accused of doing in the movie, you know, like inventing ghosts so that they can exorcise them. But I think, you know, there are two key aspects where the movie and the campaign coincide. Well, three, actually, because Ghostbusters makes such a big deal about making the guy from the Environmental Protection Agency, like, this really humorless, uptight, annoying kind of hippie type. You know, I mean, so they're against regulation. Reagan, you know, hated regulation. You know, they consider that they've come up with this fantastic entrepreneurial plan. At one point, Bill Murray says, "I've worked in the private sector. They demand results." So the Wall Street Journal picked up on this, incidentally, when they saw the movie as being, like, right there, you know, like a business school. Perfect. And the other thing is that they've invented what they call the indispensable defense science for the for the 20th century or something like that.
In 1983, Reagan announced his anti-missile defense system. He called it Star Wars. Wasn't that also a movie?
That was a movie. And, of course, you know, I think it was at that time still the top grossing movie ever. And he didn't call it Star Wars. That was the press, and that the Democrats called it Star Wars, and they thought that that was, you know, a sign that they were dissing it. It was a kind of derisive term, but Reagan understood that that was like a great term, that they handed him, you know, a wonderful trademark. I mean, George Lucas wasn't happy about it, and Reagan had this riff when they said, well, you know, they call it Star Wars, but, you know, we'll do it, and, you know, the Force will be with us, or something like that. So he pretended to object to the title, but then he, you know, like, used another phrase from the movie.
You call Star Wars, quote, a seamless blend of Walt Disney and Leni Riefenstahl. Wow.
Well, Star Wars is an amazing entertainment package. It has this, you know, grade school narrative, and I mean that literally. I mean, it is a kid's movie. The fact that it appealed, you know, universally can tell us something about what the audience wanted in those days. So it has this kind of grade school account of a rebellion against a tyranny, and it's how can you can't quite figure it out, you know, like, the princess is also part of the Republic, and, you know, I mean, it's basically like young people against young people and robots against old mean people. But the slickness of it, the way that Lucas fetishizes hardware and you know, these spectacular scenes. There are scenes that quote directly from Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, and it's not innocent. I mean, he went to film school, so he certainly was familiar with these movies, and it's not that I'm saying that Star Wars is a fascist movie, although it has been said it's a movie that a fascist audience might enjoy, but that he didn't care. It was something that worked.
In a third film we need to talk about, one of Reagan's most famous lines was, "Go ahead, make my day." This was in 1985 when he was telling Congress that he would veto any tax increase. It's Make My Day is the title of your book. And of course, it comes from a Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry movie, the 1983 film Sudden Impact. Let's talk about Clint Eastwood's persona on screen.
Okay. I mean, Eastwood was, during much of the 70s and into the 80s, the number one male star, which is to say the number one star. To me, that's very interesting because whoever's the number one star, with John Wayne for a long time, is kind of American male's ego ideal. And Eastwood was that, although the thing with Eastwood was that he was a more ambiguous character than John Wayne. He was hipper in a way. I mean, I remember when he first started making movies, people thought that, oh, maybe he's like, you know, closer to James Dean than to John Wayne. There's a certain moral ambiguity. And when he played Dirty Harry, he was a figure that I call like the legal vigilante. I mean, he could break the law because he was right. Some people saw that as a sort of fascist figure. In any case, he had some very good lines, which he could deliver, and Make My Day was one of them. I forget who did the screenplay for Sudden Impact, but it was a terrific line, and I think he delivered it to somebody. It was one of these things, you know, are they going to draw their gun? You know, yeah, go ahead and draw, and I'll shoot you, and it'll make my day, that kind of thing. But Reagan just understood it. It stayed with him. I don't think anybody wrote that for him. I think that it just popped out the way a lot of movie lines would pop out of his mouth in certain situations. And the fact that he's casting himself as Dirty Harry is very powerful. I mean, Dirty Harry was like the toughest cop in America, you know, which means the toughest cop in the world.
You end your book, Make My Day, with a terrific epilogue comparing and contrasting Reagan and Trump. Both came out of an entertainment background. Both were polished salesmen who became president, but the differences are pretty interesting. Reagan, you have said, was old Hollywood incarnate, you know, the happy ending. Trump clearly is not about happy endings, and his background in entertainment is very different.
Yes. Obviously, he's a creature of television, of reality TV, but also of Fox. I mean, he was a political pundit on Fox for a few years, and also was involved in wrestling too, and has been involved in a lot of these tawdry showbiz things. So Trump is about, understands that the kind of entertainment that he's good at and is by nature divisive. You know, you want to create villains and polarize the audience, you know, to rev them up. You know, Reagan had his demagogic instincts, certainly, particularly when he ran for governor of California, but he was more inclined to bring people together, as was said, the way that movies do, you know, make a scenario that appeals to the greatest number of people. Trump has no interest in that. I mean, he's got his audience.
Well, in your book, you say Trump is a synthesis of two great movie demagogues of 1976, Howard Beale of Network, and especially Sylvester Stallone's Rocky. Let's focus on Rocky here for a minute, because it seems to me there's a lot of Rocky in the Trump persona.
Yes. Well, first of all politicians love Rocky. I mean, the Rocky theme is the sort of the unofficial anthem of anybody running for president, any man. You know, women don't tend to use it in the same way. The thing with Rocky is that Rocky put a kind of smile face on a form of nativism, and specifically on racism. I mean, this was really the motor of that movie. The movie was all about the original Rocky, although, you know, it comes up again in the other ones, about putting Muhammad Ali, probably perceived as like the biggest threat in American popular culture since Elvis, and maybe a bigger threat, putting him in his place. And that's what that movie's about. You know, some lovable, you know, a white palooka, you know, a club fighter comes out of the past and fights this horrendous, powerful black man to a standstill. And it's that, and that's the happy ending. So, sure, I mean, that's the kind of thing that would appeal to Trump in his sunnier moves. But I think that Howard Beale, who could just get on television and rant and rave, get people to like go to their windows and respond to him, is a model for him too.
So in conclusion, you say Reagan's movie was America, the idealized happy America of his imagination. What is Trump's movie about?
I think Trump's movie is about Trump, and I think that he has succeeded in making himself such a compelling figure that he dominates this landscape. I don't know that people felt that way about Reagan. I think that Reagan was, he could be like an everyman writ large in a way, if that's what he wanted to play. You know, Trump, you know, is like the villain from a superhero movie. He's a menace. And I think people are transfixed by that. I mean, some people, I mean, it would be, you know, he certainly does not appeal to everybody. In fact, arguably, he's the least appealing president ever. But the people who like him really do like him. And it's him that they like.
Jay Hoberman, his new book is Make My Day, Movie Culture in the Age of Reagan. It's totally great. Jim, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded at the studios of Emerson College, Los Angeles, located in the heart of Hollywood, with technical assistance from Justin Allen. The theme music for our podcast is by Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. Our recording engineer is William Broughton. Alan Minsky is our senior producer. Frank Reynolds is our executive producer. Annie Shields is The Nation's engagement editor. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. For more principled progressive journalism from The Nation, you can subscribe to our print and digital magazine online at thenation.com/podcast subscribe. With this special discount for Start Making Sense listeners, you can get digital access to all of our articles for less than $1.50 a month. You can have our print magazine delivered to you for just 60 cents an issue. Go to thenation.com/podcast subscribe. You can find out more about the Start Making Sense podcast at thenation.com. And you can subscribe to Start Making Sense wherever you get your podcasts, at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Pocket Casts. I'm John Wiener. Tune in to Start Making Sense next week for more political talk without the boring parts.